Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Filmcast, a podcast about movies. I'm David Chen, and oh, so that's where they get the term minesweeper. Joining me today is Devinder Hardwar.
When one of us takes a vacation, it shall be known as the Filmcast Minus One.
And Jeff Cannata.
More like plus one to movies I've seen this year.
Wow.
All right.
Well, we waited minutes for that one, folks.
I told you I had nothing.
Yeah. That was good.
For those who don't know, you know, we generally think those up right before the episode begins. And I always check, like, do you have your thing thought up, your opening statement thought up? And today, Jeff was like, no, I haven't. And so we sat in silence for, I'm going to say, around 15 minutes while Jeff...
15 minutes.
Well, Jeff thought
hardly
that one up.
More like 15 seconds. And fine, let's just go.
Find more episodes of this podcast at thefilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Find us across all platforms at thefilmcastpod. Today on the podcast, we got a little bit of film news. We got some what we've been watching. And then, of course, our review of Godzilla Minus One, which, by the way, expanded wider in a bunch of theaters this weekend.
Doing so well, yeah.
And has currently, as of this recording, made $34 million domestically in the United States. That's awesome. It only dropped 43% this weekend. And for reasons that will become clear once we talk about the movie, you should go out and check this movie out in a theater if you have a chance. So take the opportunity. I urge you. But before we get to any of that, let's talk about some of the film news that's been going on. All right, let's start with a lighthearted one. So you guys may be aware that Netflix released more comprehensive viewing data recently. Mm-hmm. For its titles. And they released from January to June of 2023, they released like what the, you know, shows were most watched.
By release, you mean they put a spreadsheet online and was like, hey, go read the spreadsheet.
Mm-hmm.
You like numbers? Open up Google Sheets. It's amazing.
So from January to June of 2023, this is a snapshot. It's not, it's not cumulative hours or anything like that. It's just like what was popular during the time frame of January to June of 2023. The Night Agent Season 1 was viewed for 812 million hours.
Insanity.
The number one show on Netflix during that time period, The Night Agent. Ginny and Georgia Season 2, 665 million hours. The Glory Season 1, 622 million hours. Wednesday Season 1, 507 million hours. And Queen Charlotte, A Bridgerton Story, 503 million hours. So
this is undisputable proof that we are not on the pulse of the viewing populace. Nothing.
Absolutely.
We've talked about.
No, we talked about The Night Agent. Well, I did.
I watched an episode of The Night Agent. Mm-hmm. But yeah, The Glory is on my watch list. Mm-hmm. But yes,
we talked about Wednesday. You know,
you're right. You're right, Jeff. Probably not. Probably not. So, you know, most of the stuff that's on this list is not stuff we talked about on the podcast.
Yeah.
Right.
Jeff, you do not want to be on the journey of chasing what's hot on Netflix because you will just hate yourself.
Just saying, maybe we'd be a little more popular as a show if we.
If this was a Wednesday recap podcast, yeah, perhaps
we absolutely would be. Yeah.
Now, guys, I have some great news for you because I subscribe to a newsletter called Pod News, which is a cool podcast-related newsletter. They cover everything going on in the world of podcasting every day, and they released a comparison tool that allows you to compare how well your podcast is doing compared to all the shows on Netflix's spreadsheet.
That's
so
amazing. How are we re-Wednesday?
Okay, so I put in our podcast stats. The way it works, you go there, you put in your statistics, and then you click see how good you are, and then it tells you how many hours people spent consuming your podcast compared to, other Netflix shows.
We're one hundredth of a Bridgerton. Is that what we are?
It assumes that people listen to the show all the way. Like a download counts as one, mm-hmm. which is not how it works. But, you know, this is a fun game we're playing right now. Okay. So according to Netflix's data, there were 18,214 shows in the data set. And of those 18,000, 12,000 were consumed less than the Filmcast podcast.
Wow.
That means our show is bigger than 67% of all the shows on Netflix.
That's and then it lists shocking.
Here, okay, it lists here where we ranked around, okay? Your show was bigger than In Broad Daylight, The Novarty Case, Sebastian Maniscalco, Is It Me? Or Fugitive, The Curious Case of Carlos Ghosn.
Bigger than those? Massive hits?
In your face, Curious Case of Carlos Ghosn.
It's a pretty curious case. It's pretty curious.
Not curious enough.
Not curious enough. Anyway, so interesting data there that people will be talking about for a while to come. But I think one of the big, you know, I was listening to Ted Sarandos talk about it on the Town podcast, and Matt Bellany on the podcast was saying one of the reasons they release this data might be to say, it's basically metaphorically, and please, if you have kids around listening to the podcast, like, to skip forward by a minute.
Okay? Don't do that in general.
Excuse the language, okay? But it's basically Netflix taking out their huge dick and slapping it on the table and showing it to everyone and being like, this is how big my dick is. That's
spreadsheet form.
Spreadsheet form, and that's what they're doing. Yeah. And literally, like, no other platform can compare with these numbers. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Like,
so by that logic, we have a dick in the 40th percentile.
I don't understand. Jeff. I don't understand what you're
saying. We're better than 60% of the dicks on Netflix.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, that's right. 67% of all the shows. Yeah. Anyway. Right. So
the 33rd percentile.
No, but I think it will be like first of all, like, it's basically like challenging like any other streaming company. Hey, you have a hit show on Peacock? Like, hey, why don't you release the numbers? You know, like, they're not gonna because these numbers are so massive that very few other streaming services can compare. So I think it will be helpful for Netflix negotiating.
On our numbers, everybody else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Thanks for that, Jeff.
Wow.
Me? No, thank you. You're the one. I'm taking your metaphor and stroking it.
Okay. See, this is why we keep it clean, because we can't trust Jeff.
Yeah.
What?
I was just describing anatomy. You're bringing the sex stuff into it, Jeff. All right, anyway, go ahead. What are you going to say?
Nothing now.
Okay. All right.
I just had more dick references.
Yeah.
I know you're mentally just like racking them up now. So,
like, yeah. But I do think the numbers are like astronomical, and I'm curious to see what the next batch of numbers is going to bring. So
it's shocking that there's 18,000 shows on Netflix.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's shocking.
I mean, every day I log in, I'm like, that's 1,000 more shows per day.
That's
it feels
wild.
Like. So, yeah.
Also, some other interesting Netflix stats. I think somewhere like a little bit over half of the viewership is of Netflix stuff, and a little bit under half is licensed stuff, which I thought was kind of interesting. A huge percentage of the shows are foreign shows, like something like a quarter or a third, something along those lines is like foreign shows, which I thought was really interesting. It's amazing how like they've dedicated so much money to translating these shows, dubbing them and all this stuff. And I think it's really paid off for them. We've seen that with hits like Squid Game and so on and so forth. So, anyway, it's just fascinating, and I'm curious to see how other companies will respond, if at all. But it's kind of like, hey, they're one of the biggest streamers out there, so they're saying, hey, we're gonna release the numbers, and like, you know, you guys will have to figure out what you're gonna do with your numbers. But you know,
I wonder if this is a fallout a bit of the strikes, like,
yeah, for sure.
You know, the fact that they wanted to conceal these numbers for so long, now maybe it's a moot point. You know, I don't know.
It's not quite the level of data that is going to be provided to the guilds.
Of course.
And yeah, people have made the connection, Jeff, that you made of it, like maybe it's related to the strikes. Hearing Ted Sarandos defend it was interesting. He was saying how in the early days, it didn't make sense to release numbers because viewership was different. Like Nielsen was around for decades and decades. And mm-hmm. And so it's like, it doesn't make sense to compare us to them. And also, we don't even need viewers. We just want your subscription dollars. But over time, it obviously generated a ton of distrust between the platform. So between the platform and creators. So anyway.
It's interesting because the other numbers we used to see was how much money each of these services have spent on producing content. Mm-hmm. And even there, Netflix has always been like way up.
Yeah.
But then it
yeah.
was Amazon, I think Apple. Like, it's not really, there's not much competition there. Like, it's really been Amazon and Netflix for a while. And even Netflix is like way beyond Amazon. Just wild.
I also think on the flip side, there's going to be, we'll also start seeing stories, like people have been begging for these numbers. Why aren't they showing us numbers? But like, we're going to start seeing stories of a creator that got paid tens of millions of dollars to do a show. And then we see that like no one has watched it, and that will be like bad. Like, we'll start seeing fallout from that kind of thing as well. So it's we're in interesting times. So anyway, check out Netflix's viewing stats. It's available online, basically anywhere. And we are in the top 33%. When if we were a Netflix show, we'd be in the top 33%, right next to Broad Daylight, the Novartis case. So
okay. Anyway.
Another thing that happened that we want to talk about today is Andre Brower passed away very abruptly. Not something many people saw coming. And Devendra, I think you probably are the person who has consumed most of Brower's work on this podcast, is my
guess. Sure.
I'm a big fan as well, but like, tell us about like your reflections on Brower's career.
I mean, I remember seeing this guy back in the 90s, like just on Homicide. I didn't watch Homicide: Life on the Street like too much, but he was a really interesting actor and a really interesting presence in that show. When I've gone back and rewatched some of those episodes, they're just they're tremendous stuff. And to see him get this sort of like late career rise through comedy, which nobody ever really expected, but Brooklyn Nine-Nine kind of new for him. He was in the Ray Romano show as well, from like a decade ago, I believe. But Brooklyn Nine-Nine like was just a really interesting way to get this guy who is a formally trained actor. He has done Shakespeare in the Park. Like, people talk about, so many people were like, man, I'm so glad I saw him do Henry V in 1995, and it just kills me because like, we can't see that now. That was just Shakespeare in the Park. But yeah, I loved him, Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Like, he brings a level of gravitas to everything. And then most recently, he was in The Good Fight, which is a show I keep telling everybody to watch. But that is a show where they let Andre Brower just go full peacock. Like, he is a law partner who's also like a very religious man. And he has like, there's a great clip. Maybe I'll dig it up for you guys to just like get a sense of what he does in that show. But that guy commanded the screen every time he was on it. And even in Brooklyn Nine-Nine, a show that could be really silly, like, he could really bring it down to earth at times and also be silly. So I love him. I think this is tremendously sad that this hit me like a ton of bricks. Yeah.
Yeah. I always thought Andre Brower had an incredible voice. There's just some actors.
Amazing voice.
That have this voice that's so distinctive and has so much gravitas. And it's like, every time you speak, they speak, you listen. And I love that he showed this, his full range with his Brooklyn Nine-Nine work. You know, obviously a very serious dramatic actor, but then he showed he could flex his comedic muscles as well. Just an enormous talent that I think we all thought we'd have around for decades more to come.
Hey, yep. So young.
Yeah. Yeah.
61, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
Oh, so young. It's really
Jeff Cannata, any favorite Andre Brower projects?
You know, I never watched Homicide, but anytime he popped up in something, you knew that he was going to be solid in that. You guys were right that Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I think, it opened him up to a whole new audience. And what made that work is the juxtaposition between him and Andy Samberg, right? Is how ridiculous Samberg is compared to how buttoned down and, like you say, the word gravitas is one that you can't not say when regarding Andre Brower. But that's the fun, is like seeing how, you know, powerful and grounded and serious this presence is with this, you know, goofball bouncing off of it. And then, of course, the fun with Brooklyn Nine-Nine is that you get to see Brower drawn into that goofball side a little bit. It's a sad thing. And like I said, so young.
Mm-hmm.
61 just feels so young these days.
It's also super sad that he never really had a huge film career, is the other thing too. Like, he's talked about this in interviews. Like, he always wanted to be close to home. His family's in New Jersey, so he has done like a lot of local work. And he's been in films I love, like The Mist, and Salt. He is in Salt, and I'm not joking. Like, I want to rewatch like some of his like key roles at this point. And I have not seen Salt in a bit. I have not seen The Mist recently anytime soon. I want to rewatch these movies just for him.
Yeah,
gonna miss him.
Indeed. Same. Andre Brouwer, you will be missed. All right. Those are a couple film news items. And that is going to bring us to the end of our opening segment. Let's take a quick break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more and what we've been watching right after this. All right, folks. Let's get to what we've been watching. Random note, by the way, Devinder Hardwar. Salt, the
Philip Noyce movie.
I love that movie.
I love that movie. It's a great movie.
I think it's amazing. I watched that guy's next movie. So Philip Noyce. Yeah. Philip Noyce is the director. Yes. I watched his next movie.
Noyce.
The Pierce Brosnan's one?
Called Fast Charlie, directed by with Pierce Brosnan.
Yes.
Could not finish it. Could not.
I kind of want to see that, though.
I spent $15 of my own money on Fast Charlie. Could not get through the entire film, unfortunately.
Yeah, Pierce Brosnan and Marina Baccarin, who I love, but has never also been a huge film star. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, anyway, I wish I loved it. But anyway, Salt remains a good movie. All right.
This is why Dave is getting into poker, so he can start spending $15 of other people's money.
That's true.
This week, let's start off what we've been watching with the biggest movie release of the week. It's Wonka. It's a movie that Jeff Cannata and I both watched.
Jeff, did you watch it because of my text to you, or were you going to watch it anyway?
All right, so why don't you explain what the text was, Jeff Cannata?
My text was, I think Wonka is one of my favorite movies of the year. And you guys, there was a shitting upon it last week, if I recall, as we were signing off.
I was not interested in seeing it, but we all said reviews were good. People were loving it, so... Well, we knew that going
let me
in.
Say this. Let me say this. When to answer your question, Jeff, I had heard many people say that it was good, and then you know, it's possible that the Jeff Cannata text pushed me over the top, so I knew we could talk about it today. But I was intending to see it because it seemed like a good time at the theater. When I first watched the trailer for Wonka, I thought to myself, "This is everything wrong with modern IP-driven filmmaking."
You leave Paddington for this? Yeah.
The people who made this movie. Don't get the character of Wonka. It's completely unrecognizable from what we've seen in the stories. The original Wonka, even the Gene Wilder version of Wonka, and certainly the Roald Dahl version, is kind of nasty, you know, kind of mean-spirited. And then to reinvent that as this whimsical tale of wonder and this guy just trying to make chocolate for the world, it's ridiculous. It's absurd, I say. And it's just like... It represents everything wrong with what is going on in our movie industry today, and I don't wish to support it. Then I saw the movie, and I have to say, it's delightful. Now, all that stuff I said is still true. I would still argue that it doesn't fundamentally get the character, but it is a different version of the character.
Well, he's a younger version,
some
right?
Some would say so, it's an earlier, more idealistic version. Whatever.
He can get broken down over time, Dave. Like,
I need to see an earlier idealistic version of Wonka, like I need to see Darth Vader before he was evil, which is to say, not at all, I don't care. That said, it's delightful. It's a lot of fun. It's uplifting. It's a great time for the whole family. It's not the same character that we knew from the story. And it still feels pretty crass. Is that the right word I'm looking for? It still feels pretty calculated to just use this IP that they have to have access to. But I had a great time. Jeff Cannata, what did you think?
I loved it. I loved it. I also had my reservations mostly based on the Johnny Depp catastrophe, experimental catastrophe of revisiting Wonka as a character. That movie is embarrassing for all involved. And I was not certain, and certainly you guys' reluctance, nay, forbidding of having it be the main review on the show, I was uncertain as to whether, you know, this was going to be time well spent. But I took my 7-year-old to see it, and I was bowled over by the charm, the fun, the music, the visuals. This is Wonka by way of Harry Potter, or Wonka by way of Mary Poppins. It is.
And we should say, by the way, it is a musical, even though the trailers and commercials will try to conceal that fact from you.
It is extremely a musical.
Yeah.
Olivia Colman is worth the price of admission alone in this movie. She is a force. She is a tour de force. She is just a delight. I think obviously Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the original Gene Wilder film, is a world of magic, right? It's a magical world, but it is not. It does not feel like Harry Potter. It does not feel like a Victorian era, British world of, and it does not feel like Mary Poppins. It doesn't, it has its own feel that is very much not that, in my opinion. This movie is filtered through through that feeling. And there are parts of it where I'm like, man, if you just dropped me in this scene and told me it was another Harry Potter movie, I would believe you. CGI, delights and all kinds of things. And yet, there is so much heart and warmth and joy and just lovely. I mean, there are performances, people are just chewing the scenery. There's license with this movie, as there was in the Harry Potter movies, for these wonderful actors to get in and just do voices when talk in funny ways. It lets actors just chew the scenery.
Yeah, give me a warning, Jeff.
Before I do that. Yeah.
Olivia Colman's like this, and she's talking about all the little kids that she's going to throw in the furnace.
It's just like it lets actors just have so much fun, and that fun permeates. It trickles down to the audience, and I like the music is really lovely. There's some really fun, clever songs, and I'm not a musical guy. I don't love musicals just because they're musicals. I don't know. I thought the visuals were great. There's some really heartfelt moments. It takes Wonka. I think Chalamet actually is the weakest part of this movie. but he's fine. And, it does some stuff with the character that, like, okay, who cares? I don't care enough about Willy Wonka as a character to be offended in the way that sounds like Dave is.
not offended, but
it's
just more
there's a purity to that character who is both like kind of intriguing, kind of terrifying. Like, as a kid, like, that movie, that first movie is weird.
Yeah.
And I love it.
But I think that if he's now the protagonist, he can't, like, then the outside world is now terrifying and a little weird. Mm-hmm. And that's what this movie does, is like, it places him, he is Charlie, right? He is the pure, idealistic force that is now facing all of the scary outside things in the way that Wonka was the scary outside thing, right? I think that's sort of the nature of how you do a prequel, or if you do a prequel, he's the central character.
I guess
which you can argue is worthwhile or not. I'm not precious about that character the way I would be with others, for example, Darth Vader.
I think it's less like I'm precious about the Wonka character, and I care that Wonka's legacy is upheld or anything like that. It's more that there is this really mean-spirited and biting nature to Roald Dahl's books in general that are embodied in that character that I worried this movie was going to get rid of, which it kind of did.
It kind of does,
the character, right? But you just have to accept that. You have to accept that, hey, this is not going to be the version of Wonka you recognize. It is going to be something else that's lovely, which is like this wonderful, uplifting message about doing good for the world, like
if
delighting
seen
people, you know,
the two Paddington movies,
yes,
and liked them,
yes,
you will like this, yes. I think, because I love those Paddington movies. I think I like this even more than the Paddington movies, personally.
How dare you?
I know. It's.
But it's what's great about the Paddington movies and this movie is that there's just like there's a vision of this world. Like it's a fantastical, I think they allude to it being a city, but they don't say what the city is, if I recall. Like, I think,
right.
But it's like this, the physics work differently in this world, and people start spontaneously breaking out in song. It has a very specific aesthetic. And that's true of the Paddington movies. It's true of this movie. And that's very difficult to achieve. And the movie does it really successfully.
Mm-hmm. It's like Amelie or, what's the 3D Martin Scorsese movie about
Hugo?
Hugo, yeah, exactly.
It's like those movies,
vivid colors, and, yes, you know, yeah.
I mean,
and street urchins everywhere, you know, yes. Like that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Did you guys ever watch The Mighty Boosh, which Paul King directed?
Sure. Yeah.
And he did pretty much all of that series, and that's the Julian Barrett and Noel Fielding, like a British show. Love it. So I love that the guy who made that weird inventive comedy is like now doing it on the big screen and being successful at it too. So I'll check this out.
I also want to say, without any spoilers at all, the way the Oompa Loompas are handled in this movie, I hope none of it is spoiled in trailers. I suspect it might be. I mean, haven't watched any trailers.
You got to sell the movie. Yeah.
But my goodness, the Oompa Loompa concept in this movie is chef's kiss. Beautiful, wonderful. Mm-hmm. I loved it so much. Delighted me no end.
I you mentioned Chalamet earlier, Jeff. I would agree he's probably one of the weaker links. He's not a particularly good singer, he's not a particularly good dancer, but I do appreciate the effort. Like he really put his all into it, and I think he is very serviceable in the role. Like he's
got a twinkle in the eye that's required, right? Yeah. This role requires a certain twinkle. But I don't know who else I'd cast in his stead, but I do
think he makes it work.
It's perfectly, as you said, perfectly serviceable. Everyone else in the movie outshines him.
Agreed.
Because they get to just go ham.
Yes.
You know,
absolutely.
It's really fun.
I think he's trying to go ham, Jeff, is the thing. I think he's really going for it, and it's not quite reaching the same ham heights as some of the other actors, you know?
Yeah.
Sitting
next to my son.
I want to hear what your son's reaction would
be. Sitting next to him in the movie theater with candy in a movie about candy. You know, he's sitting there like one of our, we've been to very few movies together in the theater, but one of the things that I always let him do is pick out a candy at the concession stand. And he sitting there eating his candy, watching a movie about chocolate and candy and just being dazzled by it. And it just, he was leaning forward in his seat, eyes wide, and he came out of it just, he loved it. And so, it was truly one of my favorite movie going experiences this year.
That's great, Jeff.
Yeah.
Now you have to show him the original and set him straight.
I'm tempted to show him the original before we saw this. It just, we just never aligned on times.
You probably have to wait a couple of years because that movie is just like existentially,
it's a little scary,
terrifying for kids. Yeah.
I will say, there was some discussion about whether to review this, and I will say I'm okay with our decision to not review it, because when I first saw the trailer for this movie, I sank into a profound depression about the state of the movie industry, because I was like, this feels like, you know, people complained about like the Star Wars prequels for similar reasons of like, why are we going back and exploring this guy's history as like an innocent young child, and some people might argue we don't need to see that. It's not quote unquote necessary. It betrays the nature of how we understand that character. If you can let that go, like I did when I stepped into the movie theater, you'll have a great time. It's a wonderful whimsical delight, and it's a message. It has a really nice, lovely message about serving your fellow person and the importance of the bonds of friendship and love. And
I think I would sympathize more with that position if this was the first movie featuring Willy Wonka since the Gene Wilder movie, but I feel like the damage is already done. You know,
I mean, listen, it never happened. The other one never happened. We don't talk about it. So
perhaps.
Yeah. I guess, I don't know. I feel like we're going to see a similar thing, like a kind of potentially interesting dynamic take place where for most of our lives, Superman has been this kind of, has had this kind of ideal space in our head, like, or has embodied certain ideals. Then the Zack Snyder thing happened and that all kind of went away and he became a much darker, brooding character. I think it was like Jacob Elordi recently said he didn't want to be Superman because it was too dark for him, which is like, just like,
oh, good stuff.
I think I might be paraphrasing, but it's like,
yeah.
But it's like, wow, that's such a ridiculous idea that Superman could become that dark.
Also, Jacob, it's the role you were born to play.
It is, but also everybody needs to stop casting him in everything. Like he is now like top. You cast a movie, get that guy.
Yeah. Okay. Here's the Variety headline. Jacob Elordi refused to audition for Superman because that's too dark for me.
Yeah, but that
not Euphoria.
Elvis rapist movie is perfectly.
Euphoria is one of the darkest things I've ever seen. So,
well, that's amazing. This is a sign.
He's done.
Like, when I saw the headline, I was like, yeah, this is a sign of how like the younger generation understands Superman now. And hopefully James Gunn's Superman Legacy will restore that character to its rightful place in our pop culture. But
man, like Jacob Elordi, without putting on any bulk, I think like let Superman be. This is one of my little bugaboos. I know that in the comics he's always drawn as a muscle bound man,
shredded guy.
So is everybody in the comics. Like that's just how you draw comics. The idea that Superman needs to be this hulking brute, like he has superpowers that make him strong from the sun. You don't. He doesn't need muscles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean Brandon Routh did not have.
Yeah,
muscles.
I thought Brandon Routh.
Was pretty lean, dude.
Yeah, that was the
Christopher Reeve model of what this character is. Yeah,
anyway. Anyway, okay. Wonka, it's out in theaters right now. It's a lot of fun. Great time for the whole family. Check it out. It's something Jeff Cannata and I have been watching this week. Devinder Hardwar, hit us up with something you've been watching.
Oh, sure. I got to check out Leave the World Behind, which is also on Netflix now, or which is on Netflix now. It's the Sam Esmail movie.
It's been like the number one movie on Netflix for like a couple weeks. Yeah.
It's been up there for a while. Yeah.
How many percentage of our audience does it have? Where do we rank in Leave the World Behind?
I think this is a pretty big cross-section of our audience would probably check out this movie because it is about somebody we've talked about quite a bit, Sam Esmail, and also he's an interesting filmmaker. Also good cast too, Julia Roberts, Mahershala Ali, Ethan Hawke, and Maya Hala. I really enjoyed this movie, like despite the wonkiness of the ending, or I think it's a little abrupt, but I also think it's very fitting for where this movie goes. But I do want to say, like, I've always liked Sam Esmail's directorial style. He's a very purposeful director in terms of where he puts the camera and how he constructs scenes. But at the same time, like, dude, just relax. Just like. If you get a scene,
he has no chill.
You have a scene about somebody just walking into a room. The camera does not need to be like in the ceiling, facing down, giving me a bird's eye view of the entire house. You don't need that. Which is funny because I think some of the best scenes in this movie are Julia Roberts, Mahershala Ali just talking right next to each other. Simple two shot, like going back and forth. You know, everybody is. You're not doing anything fancy, like the bread and butter stuff Sam Esmail can do. He's also a good writer too. So giving these great actors his like his words, even if some of them can be kind of silly at times. I think like that's the really compelling stuff. And he just can't help himself. Like he really wants to show off and I get it. You get a big budget. You get these great stars. You want to like really make your mark. And I feel like too much of the movie kind of insisted upon itself in that way. But I did enjoy it. It's like a very timely movie about things we're all terrified about, and where it goes at the end is just like an image I've had in my head for a very long time. So I think this movie just kind of like reading my mind a little bit in terms of like, I don't know, the downfall of society or something. I think it's all really good. And really want to shout out like Julia Roberts for playing somebody who is just kind of despicable. Like you're introduced to the movie as her being like a despicable person. And she is just like really leaning into it in a way that I think is funny. And Ethan Hawke's character, self-described useless man. He is so good at being a useless man. Like it is kind of hilarious actually. So I like the character dynamics. I like a lot of what's going on here. I like pretty much all the actors too. So as far as like end of the world fiction goes, I think this one is a fun one. And according to my wife, who also read the book, like this also gives you more details in terms of what's happening that wasn't in the book. The imagery throughout it is pretty striking. There's just like a shot. There's a sequence just involving a big boat that is like pretty striking when you're watching it, you know, on a pretty large screen. And also something I think about like when I'm at the beach and like that boat's too close. What's going on there? I think it's fun. It's not a perfect film. It's not going to be one of my favorite post-apocalyptic or not sort of like end of the world type of stories, but I think it's really, really well done. And I really hope Sam Esmail gets more chances to like direct big things. Cause I think he's a talented guy. I want to see more like Mr. Robot-esque follow-ups. There's in fact, like a little bit of a nod here, putting this movie in the Mr. Robot universe, which I think is kind of fun too. The evil logo for Mr. Robot shows up a couple of times. So yeah, that's fun. I really dug it. But yeah, the ending is contentious and I understand why.
Yeah, I'm glad you liked the Devinder. I did not love this movie largely because of the ending. I think it's very anticlimactic. It ends really abruptly.
And so will we all.
It's very polarizing, I think. Mm-hmm. But it's clearly something that's gotten a lot of people talking and thinking. The movie is Leave the World Behind, and is available right now on Netflix. It's something that Devinder Hardar has been watching this week. Let's take another break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more what we've been watching right after this. Jeff Cannata, hit us up with something you've been watching this week.
Well, in addition to Wonka, I checked out the new George Clooney directorial effort called The Boys in the Boat. This is based on a book that has a special place in my heart. I'm trying to think if there's been any other. This might be the only book that my mom bought and said, you have to read this. You have to read this. I loved it so much. I need you to read this. My sister read it. My wife read it. It's a really wonderful, wonderful, wonderful book. The story is about this team of rowers. I guess it's called crew or... I know there's a more specific term, but I'm not recalling at the moment. Anyway, it's a sport that you will likely recall from the Olympics. And this is actually about a junior varsity team that goes to the Olympics in the 1930s and competes against Hitler's team, amongst a lot of other much more heavily favored rivals. And the book is beautiful and lyrical and just really a wonderful, wonderful read. And the movie is lovely too. I think it's a throwback to a simpler kind of movie. This is, honestly, I've been seeing a lot of sports movies lately, you know, between this and The Iron Claw and Taika Waititi's Next Goal Wins. And I think there's like one or more or two other sports movies that I've watched recently. This is very much a sports movie, right? This is very much an underdog sports movie. This is a feel-good, very sentimental, very sweet movie. Clooney, I think, directs it well. It's not easy, I think, to show rowing with a lot of dramatic flourish. You know, it's guys sitting and doing one thing over and over and over. It's not, you know, there are certain sports that are easy to make dramatic. Baseball is a great one. You're just standing there as the pitcher. What pitch are you going to throw? Can the hitter hit it? All these, you know, these very dramatic things. I think football is a difficult one to make cinematic, you know, but I think rowing has got to be in the one of the hardest ones because
Fincher did it in The Social Network, right? That was a pretty good rowing scene.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They used in the Hall of the Mountain King as the music, and they shot it in using like tilt shift lens, if I recall.
Yeah. So this is a number of different races. You know, obviously it's not just one race that's shown. It's a number of different qualifying races. And so Clooney is faced with the challenge of, you know, showing something, the same thing, but a bunch of different ways and making it dramatic each time. And I think he does a great job of that. That's not an easy challenge. And the movie communicates, I think, what is required to be a good, you know, that's one of the biggest criticisms I had, for example, of the Gran Turismo movie earlier this year, where I felt like it never communicated to me why these drivers were good. It just told me they were good and they started winning, but it didn't explain to me the difference between a good driver and a bad driver, right? And I think this movie does do a good job of communicating what is required in rowing to be successful and showing the trials and tribulations of getting there. But it is very much a sweet, sentimental movie. It is not attempting to do anything sophisticated. It's showing you these characters who are mostly good people trying to be good. There's not really an antagonist per se. And I think it's like a holiday sort of feel good movie. And I had a good time with it. I don't think it's reinventing the oar, so to speak.
Wow. Jeff, I saw this really mean tweet about George Clooney this weekend that I thought was...
I think it's exactly the one I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
I think Devendra retweeted it. That's why I think I saw it.
This is from former Filmcast guest Brett Arnold, who wrote in on Twitter, George Clooney is the undisputed king of directing movies that do not exist. The Monuments Men, Suburbicon, The Midnight Sky, The Tender Bar, and now The Boys in the Boat is a truly stunning run, one of the most forgettable of all time, weapons grade unremarkable.
Wow.
Which is very mean.
I hear The Tender Bar is very good.
Obviously, like, this is the thing about his movies. It's like, very few of them are outright bad. You know what I'm saying? Like, none of those movies are like outright bad, most people would argue. But I think that you expect with somebody as talented as Clooney and with the casts that he's able to assemble, you expect these movies to be like, oh, this is one of the top 10 movies that we're all going to be thinking about for years to come.
Yeah.
And it rarely achieves that.
I mean, he started strong with stuff like Good Night and Good Luck, right?
Yes, that was an awesome movie. Love that movie, right? But yeah, I think it's like, you know, the tweet is very mean and I don't endorse that behavior, but I think there's some kernel of truth. There's some truth to it where like people like, I think have difficulty remembering some of these movies, right? Like,
I'm not here to defend George Clooney's directorial career. I will say that I had a perfectly pleasant time in this film and it meant something to me that this movie was made because where the book sits in my personal family's esteem.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, like my mom was here the week before I got a screening of this and she literally considered extending her stay just to make it so we could watch it together. Like it's, the book meant something to us and it's a very sweet, I highly recommend the book. The movie I think is less special. And I think that might be what you're talking about, that it is not a remarkable movie. It is a perfectly serviceable, lovely underdog sports tale, that I think you'll come out of the theater, not feeling like your time was wasted and not feeling, you know, and you'll feel good about the world, a little bit better about the world. You feel, you know, you'll have some lovely emotional, investment, but I don't think you'll feel like, oh, this is an essential view for the year of 2023.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's lovely though. You know, some movies have significance just because they're important to the family. You know, like if my parents were really into something, then I would try to like make a screening work so that we could watch together. Even if the movie's not very good, it's like the time that you spend watching it that's valuable, right? So anyway,
and it's an amazing. I mean, it's a true story, right? It's an amazing. It's an amazing tale. The facts of it are remarkable. And so that I think it makes, you know, elevates it too, but he does a framing device. He does a Saving Private Ryan, like let's check in on the old man, you know, and the book does that too, to be fair, but you know, it's not reinventing anything. It's very sentimental. It's very schmaltzy, but I think in a good way.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting though that we are now in the year 2023 and it's like Bradley Cooper is the more interesting artistic director at this point. It's a weird because like flash forward 10 years ago, I was like, I'm really interested in what George Clooney is doing. Like he has interesting ideas. I've always liked him as an actor, but I guess it seems like Bradley Cooper's like leveraging his star power and he has clearer visions for films at this point. So,
He has overtaken George Clooney as actor turned director in some ways, who's really interesting to watch. Also, like none of George Clooney's films have done as good as Star is Born, as far as I can understand.
Which was a phenomenon and got Oscar nominations.
Huge movie. Anyway, that's The Boys in the Boat. It apparently is going to be released theatrically on December 25th. I believe it will be streaming on Amazon shortly thereafter at some point in the future. So, and that is one other thing Jeff Cannata has been watching this week. All right. I want to talk about a movie called The Mission, which is available right now on Disney Plus. This is a movie directed by Jesse Moss and Amanda McBain. If those names sound vaguely familiar to you, it's because those are the directors of Boys State, a movie that we reviewed here on this podcast. I think we all really loved that movie. I interviewed Jesse Moss. I was just very impressed by them. They have
I know it was in my top 10 of the year that year. I think it was in more.
Great movie.
Incredible movie.
Yeah, go and listen to our review of that if you have a chance. They have made a documentary about the life and times of John Allen Chow, and a missionary who attempted to make contact with one of the last untouched tribes on the planet called the Sentinelese. And this is a this is has been a widely reported news story. So you may consider this a spoiler for real life, but John Allen Chau was killed by the Sentinelese. It was an international news story that he was killed. And this documentary attempts to examine what led up to him making this decision to try and reach these people. I think this documentary is pretty good. I don't think it's as good as Boy State, but it's really interesting because it really tries to approach this question from an earnest perspective. What would cause this guy, good-looking dude, got a supportive family, has got romantic prospects, like he's everything's going okay. What would drive him to want to give up everything to possibly get murdered or killed, not even murdered, killed by this tribe who he wants to evangelize the word of God to? And I think the movie does like a pretty good job of it, of explaining like what led up to it.
I feel like that whole last part is the reasoning, but you know, yeah.
Yeah. I mean the big, so I'll just bring up a couple of things that I thought were worth noting about the movie. Like one of the big challenges of the movie that I thought kind of took away from the impact of the film is there is not a lot of footage of the main stuff that happens in the episode. I'm sorry, in the story. And so most of the movie is animated recreations of stuff, which is like, it's not bad. Like the animation is well done. It's tasteful, but it's like, you know, like it's, I am actually surprised at their decision to make a documentary given how little footage there is.
Mm-hmm. This death for documentarians, right? If you don't get the footage.
Yeah.
How do you tell the story?
Exactly. Yeah. It's no B-roll. Like, it's really hard to tell the story. People on Letterboxd are torching this film. They're giving it very negative reviews because they're like, how dare this movie try to both sides this situation? You know, like, how dare this movie try to take us into the mind of this person doing missionary work, which many people see as having colonialist undertones and is like very bad inherently. And so if you have no interest in that, like you will not like this movie. If you're like, all missionaries are terrible and I don't think we should try to understand them at all, then don't watch the movie. But if you are interested in what would drive people to do this in like present day times, what would drive people to do this? This movie will give you some good insight into that. And as a recovering evangelical Christian myself, like I found it to be very interesting. It doesn't really judge John Allen Chau particularly harshly. And I think that's what a lot of people were disappointed at. People wanted this movie to judge John Allen Chau very harshly. I mean, I think it's very clearly from the perspective, the movie is clearly from the perspective that what he did was not a good idea and he should not have done it. But it's not like this guy was dumb and he never should have done this.
Is there an exploration of like evangelical culture in there? Because I feel like that's what you got to do.
100%.
To tell the story. Yeah.
100%. There is an examination of the culture that would create the mindset that this guy, that would make this guy want to do this. I found it to be fascinating. I thought it was a pretty interesting movie. It's available right now on Disney Plus. The movie is called The Mission. It's about the final days of John Allen Chau. And it's something I've been watching this week. So anyway, that's another item on the What We've Been Watching list. Devendra Hardwar, tell us about something else you've been watching this week.
Sure. I've also been watching Carol and the End of the World. I'm really on the whole End of the World stuff right now. Also fully caught up on Murder at the End of the World. Totally separate series. Carol and the End of the World is the new animated adult series on Netflix. It's created by Dan Gutterman. He used to write for Rick and Morty, Community. He was a head writer of like The Onion for a very long time in like the 2000s. So really interesting like background going into this. And this show is kind of fascinating because it is, if you can think of an anti Rick and Morty, right? If Rick and Morty is loud and funny and laugh a minute, this show is slow and ponderous and constantly makes you think about society and like why you do what you do and how we all interact with each other and what we owe to each other. It's a really sweet, slow burn series. Basically about this woman named Carol, who's very normal. Except the world is going to end. They know the world is going to end. There's a planet in the sky. It's headed right at Earth. It gets bigger every day. It's on track to like obliterate the planet in like 8 months. So because of that, everybody on Earth basically is just like, screw it. I don't have to work anymore. Like, I'm going to be my best self. I'm going to live my best life, because there, we know the end is coming, right? Like, the trappings of living a normal life, of having a job, of capitalism and everything are just kind of evaporated. So that's kind of fascinating. Except Carol is this person who is just very, very normal and chill and just does not want to leave the old world behind. So she is not living her best life. She's in fact like having a bit of a crisis because everybody around her is having orgies and having like fun times and learning new skills. And her sister is like skydiving and telling everybody all the time. She just misses Applebee's, you know? So it's a very, very interesting juxtaposition of like, I think we all think about like, if we knew the world was going to end, maybe just throw the shackles of society behind and go be free, be wild. And this woman just can't, because of who she is and what she wants from the world. And maybe she doesn't fully understand herself. So I'm like halfway through the series right now. I think it's really insightful. It's really funny at times. The animation is really good too. And the, just like the visuals of how they imagine like the world responding to imminent doom. It's basically Melancholia, Lars von Trier's Melancholia, right? Where a thing you knew was going to come and smash Earth. And that movie was about people coming to terms with that too. This is if you have a direct timeline, there's nothing you can do. Earth is gone in 8 months. How do you live your life? I think it's kind of fascinating. It's not a laugh a minute show, but it is really funny at times. It's really sweet and endearing and insightful. Like, I'm not sure if you guys will like this, but if you want like interesting adult animation, it's very BoJack at times in terms of how like depressing it can be. It's worth a look. I think this is like a really good BoJack successor. I'm constantly just wanting this woman to like be just like, come on, live a little. Just come on, do more. Like,
one
get
orgy.
Out there.
Just one.
Just one orgy. I mean, her parents are in a throuple. It's a whole thing. They're also nudists. That's funny. It's deeply funny. I think it's really funny, but it's also very much an adult show of like, also if you're at a point in your life where you're looking at, I don't know, civilization not doing so well right now, impending wars all over the place, it is a really interesting thought experiment to have. So if you were disappointed by Leave It All Behind, I think this is actually a good way to like explore, I don't know, how society would react to things really falling apart. So yeah, Carol and the End of the World, I recommend it, but it's not for everybody.
Yeah, it sounds like it's for me though. So
I think it is very much for you.
I'll try to check this out. Yeah, Carol, the End of the World on Netflix. It's something else.
How much will you miss Applebee's? Be honest.
Well, let's talk about that actually. So do you guys have one of those favorite like chain restaurants? Oh, when
Red Lobster, yes. Red Lobster and the Cheddar Bay Biscuits. It's my life.
I was a Chili's guy myself. We had
Chili's
right by the house, you know?
In fact, that's a line. Like, what's Applebee's? Is that like a Chili's? And she's like, no. It's not like a Chili's. It's very different.
Jeff Cannata, any favorite one of those like kind of mid-tier chain restaurants?
Crumble Cookies count?
I've never heard of
that. Yes. Yeah.
You know what that is? Crumble Cookies?
No.
I know what Crumble Cookies is, but
oh, sweet
not really, really restaurant. Did your family just not go to those restaurants when you were a kid?
No, we didn't.
Pizza Hut Dine-In?
Yeah, Pizza Hut would be like a really popular
one. I mean, I've never done the Pizza Hut Dine-In. I love Round Table Pizza, but that's not like, we wouldn't, I don't know. I guess Round Table, I miss Round Table. I don't know if most people even know what that is.
What is Round
Table? Specific to the West Coast. Mm. But it's one of the last honest pizzas. It's my favorite pizza. Yeah.
If it's from the West Coast, that can't be true, Jeff. Sorry.
Yeah, no, we never really would go. I mean, I guess Cheesecake Factory is the closest.
That's one.
That,
yeah, like,
I could never go there again. And be
that menu is too
fine.
Big.
Oh yeah, yeah. Actually, guys, I got to tell you about this story. Okay, sorry to take a little break from the podcast here, but I go to see a lot of movies at the South Center Theater in near Seattle. It's like it's about a 25-minute drive south of Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
The reasons I go to that theater are first of all,
Chili's.
It has a Cheesecake Factory, but it has a really nice AMC. It has Dolby and IMAX, tons of showtimes, and also because it's in a kind of a suburby area, it's free parking. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the city, you got to pay like $10 to park. So I'm like, so I like driving south, going to South Center. The problem is that at South Center Mall, which like the AMC is part of, people get shot with some regularity. Mm. Like people get murdered. On a somewhat regular basis.
That's just another day in America. But yeah.
And literally one of the shootings happened in a cheesecake at the Cheesecake Factory in the mall on a Tuesday, which is like, That is the most emotion anyone has ever experienced in a Cheesecake Factory on a Tuesday. Mm-hmm.
So, it's a whole new meaning to the phrase bang, bang, chicken and shrimp.
Mm-hmm. My wife and I, you know, it was Friday night, and my wife and I were like, I was like, I got to go see Wonka because Jeff Cannata is going to kill me if I don't go see it. And so we go down to go see, and my wife's like, look, I don't want to go there on Friday or Saturday night because that's when usually the stuff happens, right? So we go to see Wonka at like the 9:30 p.m. show, and we get out of the theater at 11:45 p.m. Come in, we're walking to the car, and literally a massive fight is breaking out in the park. Like, we saw someone shove someone else and scream like, I'm gonna effing kill you. And then so at that point, my wife and I, we like literally
check,
just
please.
turned right around, went back inside. I'm like, we're gonna wait this out.
And they're like, Wonka is a relevant reboot, damn it.
And that's what I wanted to say is I did not know there were so many Roald Dahl purists out there.
Anyway,
this
is probably in poor taste, but you know, whatever. It's on brand for me. I remarked to my wife, I was like, you know, you said, oh, there was a shooting at this place, you know, because you know we live very close to Columbine, for example, and stuff like that. It's very depressing and hard to even think about. And you know, we're all constantly thinking about our kids. And I remarked to my wife, you know, you never hear about a shooting happening at the same place twice. So I feel like once the shooting has happened at the place, maybe that's where you go. Maybe you just go to the shooting place.
It happens all the time.
Hold on. First of all, to just wrap up the story, we waited inside, and then literally the police came. Like, police came, and they were like taking statements from people. So once the police came, that's when we like decided to go into our car. But it was like a little scary, and also it made me really reflect on whether or not I wanted to get injured or harmed after filming of Wonka, after screening of Wonka. Like,
what
that's
movie
probably
would be worth getting?
The Matrix. You know, like.
You're just pumped. Golly. You're very pumped to ready to get the mini fight.
Martin Scorsese movie, you know, like those would be movies where it's like, okay, that's worth like endangering yourself for potentially.
We drove by the movie theater here in, I mean, there's a lot of shootings in Colorado, sadly, but we went by the movie theater that was very famous nationally because there was a shooting at the Dark Knight.
The Dark Knight, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I guess that would fall in your purview of.
I want to leave a note for our international listeners here. If this sounds horrifying, this is life in America.
Actually horrifying.
This is,
If
it sounds horrifying, that's only because it is horrifying.
And we are living in it. Yeah.
That the idea that you have to contemplate these things just to go outside is.
My kids have safety drills and their daycare. Like, it's all terrifying. It all sucks.
And to be clear, I was, you know, I don't think any movie is worth endangering your life. Right? I was being facetious. It's terrible. But yeah, I was literally like quite frightened when we started going, and like, I know that incidents have happened at this mall. But it just was like the fact that it was a movie called Wonka. That's what was like, is this really it for me? Like, is it going to be from a Wonka screening?
Anyway. I mean, you know, that's just a local brawl. You know, we walk by those all the time. I do want to say, though, Dave, one of my favorite lines from Step Brothers will probably apply to you at some point. Going to head down to the Cheesecake Factory and have a drink. That's you. That's
indeed,
you.
Indeed.
And the follow up, you smell like whiskey and cheesecake.
I don't want to get too far away from explaining to you guys what crumble cookies is.
Okay, we are really far away from that, but
we're so far.
Yeah, it's a chain that sells cookies, right? I've been there.
That
I like
is so reductive, Dave. How dare
do they also
you?
Crumble?
Crumble Cookies changes their menu every week, so there's new cookie varieties every single week. Which means if you're a part of our household, we have to go every single week to find out what the cookies are.
And oh, they got you. Yeah.
Oh, dude.
Yeah.
It's best cookies. B, they come up with these wild, amazing flavors, and they do things with the texture that sort of evoke the like there's like a cotton candy one, like the texture is like cotton candy, or it'll, I mean, cotton candy is a poor example, but there are all kinds of like wild, inventive, cool flavors. They have cookies that are like pies. They have it's the best, and there's and it's every week is new. It's
this
a
is the Cold Stone of cookie companies, I guess.
It's puts Cold Stone in the
near Seattle area. Mm-hmm. So
anyway. It's also the fastest growing chain in the world for the past 2 years or something. We're addicted over here at the Kanata household.
All right. Well, there you have it. Devendra's choice is a Red Lobster. I'm a Chili's guy. And Jeff's a Crumble Cookies guy.
Mm-hmm. Listen, those Cheddar Bay biscuits are fantastic. Like, I can live on those things. They'll kill me. But yeah.
Thanks for going with us on that journey, listeners. All right. I had a couple more things I wanted to bring up in what we've been watching.
I want to talk about this one with you.
I watched Eileen.
Yes.
And I don't even want to give away what the genre of movie this is, because I think some people might not appreciate hearing about that.
Kind of a thriller. How about that?
Sure.
Kind of a thriller, this movie.
It stars Thomasin McKenzie and Anne Hathaway. Thomasin McKenzie lives a sad life and works at a prison. And then one day, Anne Hathaway joins the prison, and she's like a super glamorous person.
She's blonde.
She's glamorous. She wears like really stylish clothes.
Is this in theaters right now?
In theaters right now.
This is also, it's a period movie. It's like outside of Boston, right? So they have the great thick New England accents, which you must love.
I am begging filmmakers to stop having characters speak with Boston accents.
Yeah.
I promise you, if you set a movie in Boston and no one speaks with a Boston accent, zero people will say, where were the Boston accents in it? On the flip side, every person in this movie speaks with a slightly different bad Boston accent. And that is very noticeable. And I will definitely criticize the movie for that.
We're going to put all the kids in the furnace.
That's
how they sound, governor.
It's Olivia Colman in Boston.
Anyway, Eileen, this is a movie out in theaters right now. It's now, look, we're at the time of year where I am looking through a lot of other critics' top 10 lists and trying to prioritize what I'm going to watch. And Eileen has shown up on some top 10 lists. And I have to say, I did not like this movie very much at all.
I would have put money on that, but yeah.
I mean, hey, I was really into it. I will just say this is, you know, there's that line from Anchorman, wow, that escalated quickly.
That escalated quickly,
this is,
yes.
Wow, that escalated quickly, the movie. And I'll just leave it at that. I did not think I thought the structure of the movie really hurt the movie. And when it ended, I was literally laughing in disbelief that that was it. That was how the movie chose to end. I'm trying to be extremely vague. There are some great performances in the movie. And I don't even want to say who the performances belong to, because I think that would be a spoiler. I'll just say that like some of the performances are really wonderful, and there's some nice, funny, disquieting moments. So it's not like this is a complete disaster that you should watch or anything like that, but I think it's wildly uneven. And I don't feel like the ending really justifies what the movie is trying to do. Devendra, I think you like this movie a lot more than me, right?
Yeah, I think this movie is a ton of fun because it is wildly uneven and it goes places you don't expect. But I certainly watching this, I'm like, oh man, tonal inconsistencies. Chalk this one up. That bad Dave's gonna
put
hate this.
This in Dave's bad column.
Exactly.
This is gonna get a lump of coal from Dave's stocking.
I predicted this back at Sundance, but I think it's a fascinating movie because of how weird it is, because it doesn't really go where you expect. I think both Thomasin McKenzie and everybody, honestly, like Shea Whigham's in this, plays her dad. It's a weird movie. I feel like it at times starts weird and it doesn't like keep up the weirdness. Like I don't mind the tonal shifts. I don't mind like where things go by the end, but I do feel like maybe it could have kept up the sort of like environment of weirdness, because I think most of this movie you're expecting it to be, oh, this is kind of a thriller. This may be sort of like a lesbian coming of age story. Yeah. It is all of those things and becomes something else. And I think has one of the creepiest, like final monologues, like just creepiest sequences, just disgusting things that I can imagine. I was like, well, that movie went there.
Right.
And that is kind of fascinating.
I mean, I know what you're talking about. There's an incredible scene, but it's like, it's one of those movies that's two movies
Yes.
Like awkwardly grafted together.
I feel like three movies. It's like, yeah. It's a multiple movies. Yeah, for sure.
So I was not a big fan of it, but I know, again, it's on a lot of people's top 10 lists, and there is some interesting stuff in it. So I'm not saying don't go watch it, but it wasn't for me. Devendra liked it a lot. Yeah, I don't know. I really didn't connect with me, this one, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But the movie is Eileen, and it's out in theaters right now. Finally, I have one last thing to mention for what we've been watching, and that is I watched a movie called Sam Now. This is a movie that I saw on Matt Zoller Seitz's top 10 movies of 2023, and it was actually also filmed in the Seattle area, so I appreciate that about it.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, this is a movie directed by Reed Harkness. It's a documentary, and Reed Harkness's family experienced the disappearance of their mom some decades ago, right? Like one day the mom abruptly vanishes. She's alive. She's not like been murdered or anything, but she decides to vanish and leave and go somewhere else. Why did she leave? Where did she go? What happened? Those are the questions the movie tries to answer. And I think it's a pretty interesting movie. I didn't love it because I think the ending wasn't super strong, but it's a documentary where like this guy is taking you into his family's life and showing like what the impact of such a thing happened. Like if your mom were to just suddenly get up and leave one day and never talk to you for years and years, and you know, like what kind of impact would that have on a family? This movie, Sam Now, documents that impact and also documents their quest to find her and figure out what happened. So I think it's pretty interesting. Didn't love it, but I did like it. I have a lot of affection for it because there are some really great moments that were captured on camera, some really powerful, moving moments. And so ultimately I end up liking it, but I didn't love it. But you know, if the premise is interesting to you, it might be worth checking out. The movie is called Sam Now, which I think is a cool name, by the way. Sam is one of the people in the, one of the members of the family. And it's like Sam Now versus Sam before, you know, like we're all just evolving people on a continuum, right? Sam Now is the name of the movie, and it is available on video on demand for rent or purchase. And if that premise interests you, then you should check it out. And it's one of the things I've been watching this week. All right, that's going to bring us to the end of what we've been watching. Let's get to weekly plugs. Weekly plugs, the part of the show each week where we plug something else we've been making. This week, I want to plug my free newsletter, Decoding Everything, where I wrote a post called 7 Predictions for the World of Entertainment in 2024. And I predict 7 things that I think are going to happen next year when it comes to the world of entertainment. Number one on the list. More. What'd you say, Jeff?
Couldn't think of 3 more.
nice round number, you know?
Actually, my understanding is lists that have a prime number of list items do better, like from a traffic perspective.
That would be something you would know.
It's so weird. Yeah.
That would be something I would what, Jeff?
No.
Yeah, of course.
Unusual numbers do better, I guess. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So anyway, 7 predictions for the world of entertainment 2024. Number one on the list, the film cast is going to be more popular than 68% of titles on Netflix.
Hey-o! Get that percentage up.
Instead of 67%. So there you go. Anyway, check it out at decodingeverything.com. It's my free newsletter. You should totally subscribe. Devendra Hardwar, your weekly plug.
Oh, sure. Check out the latest episode of the Engadget podcast. We talked about the death of E3, which I'm sure you have a lot of feelings about, Jeff. But we talked about it with Jessica Condit from Engadget and just, you know, our feelings on that whole event and it being officially dead. And we went over some of the Game Awards announcements as well, because the Game Awards happened right after our previous episode. So anyway, a lot of video game stuff in the Engadget podcast. Check it out.
All right. And Jeff Cannata, your weekly plug.
Are you looking for a last minute gift? Huh? Are you freaking out? I don't know what to get. Oh, it's the time's tick, 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 ticking until the holiday. You got to get a gift. Might I suggest a limerick? Ha ha! You can get one from me, made for you or your loved one, personalized, delivered via video over at cameo.com/Jeff Cannata. People love them. Check out over 150 5-star reviews on my Cameo page. Folks, digging the limericks. Cameo.com/Jeff Cannata.
I want to give a shout out to patreon.com/filmpodcast, where you can sign up for ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus After Dark episodes. We really appreciate everyone at Patreon that can support this work. This week, coming up on the After Dark, we got a review of American Fiction with Jordan Minor. That was a lot of fun to record. Of course, we also have reviews of Saltburn and The Holdovers on the After Dark, and a bunch of other stuff there where we check in with folks every week. Patreon.com/filmpodcast, how you can support this show. We really appreciate everyone's support this year. Of course, we never want anyone to donate if it in any way causes them financial hardship. You can always support us for free by leaving a review for us on Apple Podcasts or sharing about the podcast on your social media. Thanks to everyone who makes this podcast possible. Let's get to our review of Godzilla Minus One. Welcome to the Filmcast review of Godzilla Minus One. I'm going to read the plot summary from the internet. Japan is already devastated by the war when a new crisis emerges in the form of a giant monster. Wouldn't you know it, in a Godzilla movie, I wouldn't have predicted. Okay. This is a movie directed by Takashi Yamazaki. It is being distributed by Toho. It's doing very well in United States box office right now. And, you know, guys, I feel like we've had a bit of a mixed track record when it comes to the Godzilla movies, right? Like, some of them have been great. Some of them have been not great. Some of them have been forgettable.
Well, also depends on where they're coming from, you know?
There's different varietals of Godzilla movie, you know?
Yeah, and the American Godzillas have not always been successful. But I think the Japanese ones have been.
Yeah, I mean, Shin Godzilla, great movie. You know, Roland Emmerich's Godzilla, not a great movie.
Movie.
And then there's this whole, like, monsters universe that Universal has. And I'll be honest, you know, I think of those, probably the Gareth Edwards Godzilla is the one I like the most. And the other ones have not been terrible, but I think have been kind of forgettable in some ways. I know a lot of people are really into the Monarch Legacy of Monsters TV show going on right now.
And the Kong Skull Island movie, no Godzilla, but still good in that universe.
So anyway, Godzilla, definitely a character creature that is in the popular consciousness to varying degrees of success and quality, depending on the film. So that said, into the picture walks Godzilla Minus One. Now, let me just say one thing before we actually start this review. I think a lot of people have the question, do I need to have seen any Godzilla movies to appreciate Godzilla Minus One? I don't think so. I think you could go in. This could be your first ever Godzilla movie that you've ever seen, and you would still enjoy it, you know, as much as somebody who's, or not as much, but like you would still be able to enjoy it greatly.
Very much a standalone movie.
Yeah, very much. I would say if this is your first Godzilla, you should go watch the original. Go watch Gojira, because I think that is a tremendous film. It still holds up today.
All right. Jeff Cannata, I'm going to start with you, because Devendra has already talked about his thoughts about this movie on the podcast previously. I'm really curious. What did you think of Godzilla Minus One?
Well, Dave, I guess you could say what I thought about Godzilla Minus One is best summed up in the form of a limerick.
Hit us with it.
It's cool when Godzilla attacks, because we see its larger impacts. In this case, minus one is an equation for fun, because it adds more than it subtracts.
Wow. Nice. Nicely done. That was a good
with
one.
Math play.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Now, with the caveat that I haven't seen all of them, this is my favorite Godzilla movie. Period. Do I think it is wholly successful 100% of its running time? I do not. It's a little clumsy in some of the emotional moments early on in the movie. The sort of the first act, I think, can get a little bogged down in its own emotional weight. It's a very melancholy movie, and I think the pacing suffers a bit at the beginning. That said, by the third act, when it's really cooking, whoo, doggies, is this fun. I had a great time with it. I love that it's a period piece. I think that's cool. And it really speaks to the central metaphor of Godzilla, right? Godzilla is this nuclear threat that Japan has faced in a way that no other nation has. And, you know, I think the best science fiction, and in this case, you know, science fiction slash horror action monster movie, can really speak to something that is a universal truth that is a real issue in the world. And I think this movie very much does. It has people at its center, which is something I think any movie of this type struggles with, because the star of a King Kong movie is King Kong. The star of a Godzilla movie is Godzilla. Why am I spending time with people? I want to see the big monster smack things, right? That's what I paid my popcorn money for. This movie, I think, handles that better than most in that it gives really compelling reasons to be invested in these people and their plight. And it really broadens it. Yes, we have a central character who has some very specific issues that the movie spends a lot of time with. But I think even more than that, this is a movie about a culture and a class of people. Very much speaks to, you know, this is a movie about sort of the rural grassroots battle against Godzilla. And I loved it for that. I thought that was very fun. And seeing people come together and come up with a very unorthodox plan in how to deal with it. Even at a certain point, I was like, this is the plan? Really? This is what we're going with? I kind of loved how unconventional the plan was. And it's very fun to see it executed. I also think this movie very much feels influenced by Spielberg. I think there's the first action scene is Jurassic Park. The second action scene is Jaws. You know, like you can see the DNA that has been plucked from those experiences. And I think the action scenes on the whole are very, very well done. I think the effects in the film are very, very well done. I found the size and scale of Godzilla to be very believable. The way it has to be handled, very believable. I was transported into this world, and I just thought it handled everything with a – there's not that cheese level that I think a lot of people like about the early Godzilla films is not present. For me, that's a boon. I like that this movie handles it with a level of realism and seriousness. But it's still really thrilling and really fun. And it still has, you know, it still has cool, bombastic, killer moments. I just thought this was almost complete success. I feel like you could trim like 15 minutes of the sort of melancholy work up to it and you wouldn't lose much. And I think the pace would benefit. But like I said, by halfway in, it gets cooking and the last act is really fun and really satisfying. And just like all the pieces are on the chessboard and you see how it's all playing out. And I was just in it. So I liked Godzilla Minus One quite a lot.
I think Jeff's underselling it. Mm-hmm. I think this movie is incredible. I had an amazing time with this movie. It's one of my favorite films of the year. And Jeff nails one of the things that it gets right, which is it makes you care about the human characters. That's been so hard to do in certainly the American Godzilla films that we've seen, right? Like I struggle to relate to you anything that happened to any of the human characters in any of those films.
You don't care about Ford Brody?
The only
Aaron
thing
Taylor
is
Taylor Johnson's Ford Brody.
I remember Bryan Cranston's wife died in the movie,
yes.
Like that, and it was
but
she
not
played
because
by
of
like,
Godzilla, right?
Like, was she played by like Juliet Binoche? I want to say, or
I believe so. Yeah,
she wasn't killed by Godzilla though, right? We all remember that. Or
it was a separate thing.
Yeah, it was Godzilla related though. I think Jeff,
was it?
If I recall correctly.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah. I remember Bryan Cranston was good in that movie because
anyway, point being, we all struggle to even, you know, like there's some deaths that we like, oh my gosh, I'll never forget how Spock died, you know, in Wrath of Khan. Like we'll never, but it's like a lot of
Godzilla
people
Godzilla smashed him.
No, I want to see that movie.
This is a movie that starts from the premise of, hey, let's make characters who we really care about and are invested in their fate. And I think it does a really good job of it. Visual effects look amazing. The movie costs, I think, something on the order of like $15 million.
That's crazy.
It's incredible what they were able to achieve for that amount of money. Godzilla himself looks really convincing and formidable. And also, you know, Jeff, I don't remember if you brought this specific thing up, but I thought about you because let's just say that the way in which they choose to address the Godzilla problem is extremely creative.
Yeah, it's fun.
And I think that it's also distinctly not American. Like the way, if this was a movie made in America, like we would just keep like throwing nukes at it. We would keep like,
what about a bigger bomb?
Like, and it's like they in this movie, the Japanese really quickly realize like that's not the way to go, and they figure out an alternate path that we'll talk about later in spoilers.
However, I will say that plan does have. Is based on some really big assumptions.
not quite a foolproof plan.
Yeah. I just thought this was a home run. And as you said, Jeff, the final act is like really incredible. Like I'm on the edge of my seat. There's multiple iconic moments from the movie where I'm just like, oh my God, what an incredible moment that I'm going to remember for a really long time to come. So it delivers everything I am looking for in blockbuster filmmaking. It's amazing. Godzilla Minus One. Go see it in the theater. Devendra Hardwar, a few other reflections before I get to some spoilers.
I mean, I think the Spielberg comparisons, I mentioned Jaws and some of that, like when I was talking about it. But yeah, it's true. Like this is American blockbuster filmmaking filtered back through Japan through like a traditional Japanese property too. And I think that whole aspect of it is really fascinating. I like the human stuff. I like the characters. I wish, we'll talk about this in spoilers, but I wish the character of Noriko, like there was just more going on there, especially with how they set her up and kind of how she progresses. I feel like that's a little weird. This movie could have been trimmed, but at the same time, I think the melodrama does kind of help to sell the stakes a little bit too. Like there are multiple moments where I'm like worried about certain characters and worried about the peril that they're in. I think this movie really, really sells that. I think the thing that really works here, by the way, is that Godzilla has weight. Godzilla is terrifying. And looking at the trailer for that new thing coming, Godzilla X Kong, Cross Kong, the new Empire directed by Adam Wingard, nothing. Like Godzilla's just running around. Like there's no like sense of scale or how such a creature that's so large would have to move. Whereas this one, like Godzilla's not fast, but Godzilla is brutal. You know, and you feel the weight of it at all times. I just love that. Because even the Japanese movies like ended up being more campy progressively as Godzilla became more of a good guy and not a terrifying guy. And this one, Godzilla's not a good guy. Godzilla is the terrifying force. Maybe humans like are partially at fault for Godzilla appearing, but he is terrifying. And I think that's it's tremendous. This movie sold that so well.
Yeah, I watched this YouTube video by Kurtz Gesagt a while ago. Do you guys know Kurtz Gesagt, the science YouTube channel? Yeah. And they did this thing of like explaining why things are the size they are. Like, why are insects, why don't we have any 6 foot tall mosquitoes? And why don't we have
big insects?
You know, why are these things the way they are? And it's because of basically the volume to surface area rule, where you notice how like chipmunks, their hearts are beating like super fast, and like the elephants, their hearts are beating super slow. And it's because like the way that blood travels through the body, the way that their body dissipates heat, you know, if a chipmunk suddenly blew up to massive size, it would like overheat and explode basically, and so on. And anyway, so like there's a reason why things are the size, like there's a reason why it feels right that a massive creature like Godzilla would move so slowly. And I think Jeff, you haven't seen the trailer, but in the new trailer, he's kind of like bounding around like a, you know,
with King Kong,
like a dude, you know, and it's like, it doesn't really make any, but this Godzilla Minus One gives Godzilla like this weight and this, this size that is really formidable and frightening. It really does honor to the character, I think. Anyway. Any other thoughts before we get to spoilers? I think
good use of the theme, by the way. I think the Godzilla theme, the original theme, is one of those like powerful pieces of movie music, and I love to hear it deployed. So it works really. They build up to it here really
well. Yeah, and the score overall, I think, is very, very strong. So, yeah. All right. I'll say one last thing before we get to spoilers, which is like, I got very emotional during the movie. I think like there is just some moments where I was I was not prepared to cry at a Godzilla movie. You know, like I was like, oh, this will be fun. And then there are some moments that are just deeply moving, I found. And so anyway, just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah. And I also, you know, Shin Godzilla is such an interesting concept and I think a clever take. But the thing it was missing for me is what this movie gets so well, which is like it also has it's kind of got the boardroom, like how are we going to deal with this planning, like figuring it out sort of structurally and logistically. But it also adds like just kick-ass action, you know, which I think Shin Godzilla is really missing.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Let's get to spoilers for Godzilla Minus One starting right now.
I thought up an ending for my book.
It makes no damn sense.
Compels me, though.
I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end.
When I buy a new book, I always read the last page first. That way, in case I die before I finish, I know how it ends.
You can't handle the truth!
Inconceivable!
I came here to tell you how it's going to begin.
All right, so many things to talk about when it comes to themes of this movie. I will say that there's a lot that I don't know because I'm not Japanese about what this movie's trying to say about Japan and how it prosecuted the war. Mm-hmm. I think that obviously the movie is very negative about how Japan handled its citizens during the war. Like
it positions the citizens as like pawns of the government, basically.
Fodder.
Fodder. And it's very regretful. And I think the idea of Godzilla is this, if I had to posit, right, and this is not like earth shattering or anything, but it's just like it allows Japan to imagine themselves as the heroes in this war that I imagine many people find disgraceful, right? Like, where, hey, yes, we lost the war, and by the way, the army was completely disbanded and like tons of weaponry thrown into the ocean and all this stuff. But what if we could have fought against a thing where we won and that showed like the best sides of us, right? Like for the United States, that we have a thing that's called World War II is that for the United States. That is in fact one of the last times when I think it was unequivocally quote unquote good what we are fighting for.
I think it's more than that too in this movie, because it's not just we had something to fight for that was noble. It's that we have chosen to fight, and there's no top down direction here. It is a bottom up experience.
We can do it in a way
experience.
That is like that honors everyone, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it is. It is. We are stepping up. It is this grassroots. Like we choose the manner and method of our own salvation. We are not. No one's saying, okay, you, go crash your planes into those aircraft carriers. It's we have decided we are going to do this. We are going to figure out how to get it done. This isn't the Japanese military rebounding from World War II and figuring out how to Godzilla. Yeah. It's the people. It's the citizenry. And I think that is a powerful aspect of it. It certainly resonated with me, this notion of recapturing our autonomy, our identity, our ability to make our own decisions.
Yeah, and Godzilla is a vessel through which they can have that reimagining, right? Which I think is kind of interesting. Also, by the way, did you guys get a Dunkirk tingle at the end of this movie?
There's a lot of Dunkirk. Both, there's a lot of like big
both
American
movies
action
end
movies.
With like a huge amount of civilian ships showing up to theoretically save the day. I thought that was kind of interesting.
How do they have time to attach all those tugboats? That's just like a very difficult thing to do,
right? They just like cut to the tugboats are attached,
like 40 tugboats all attached at once. I'm like, that would have taken a week.
So the way in which they choose to try to kill Godzilla is super cool. Like they try to
give him the bends, baby.
Yeah, give him the bends. like this is a creature that can shoot lasers out of its mouth. We don't know if it's actually gonna be subjected to the human laws of physics at all. I was a little bit bummed that basically everything the scientist does is pretty much completely inconsequential to destroying Godzilla by the end, right?
Like, pretty much, yeah.
They sink him down, they bring him back up. He doesn't get hurt in either direction, really.
But what if big plane has bomb,
It's great. What if plane with bomb? Yeah.
I liked the first half of the plan. Like, sink him.
Yes.
And then he's like, oh, let's bring it back up and give him the bends. It's like, okay, listen, this is a creature that comes from the deepest part of the ocean. Do we think that the bends even applies to said creature?
I don't think Godzilla was like slowly surfacing to make sure he didn't get nitrogen narcosis, you know?
But he was born in it. He was raised by it.
Let's just keep him at the bottom. But he's chewing through the things. Okay, but how long is that going to take? I don't know. It just feels like... like there's a lot of assumptions about the anatomy of the Godzilla. You know what I'm saying?
There are, okay, putting that aside, though, there are so many amazing moments early on in the movie. The initial attack, as you said, like very Jurassic Park inspired. The attack on the city on Ginza.
So good.
Very
so
well
good.
Done. The moment when his female partner pushes
incredible.
Him.
Incredible.
It's just like.
Incredible. The like the wind going through there and all the shrapnel.
And she's like, but
by the way, though, girl, like. Push and jump.
Yeah.
Don't push and stay. Push and jump.
She only had energy for one piece. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
But that image is so powerful and so cool.
Especially for a guy who already has survivor's guilt too. He's like, oh man, just layering it on. Yeah.
Well, there is this, first of all, you know, in the wake of Oppenheimer, I did get some questions from people saying like, Oppenheimer tells the story from the perspective of the white people, basically, right? Mm-hmm. And the Japanese perspective is completely excluded from Oppenheimer, which is fine. Like, Christopher Nolan wants to make that movie. I did get some questions of, like, what was it like? What movie should I watch for perspective from the Japanese people? And there is a documentary called White Light, Black Rain, The Destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which is a documentary that was on HBO about what it was like for people who were nearby when the bomb went off. And I thought that was a beautiful title, White Light, Dark, White Light, Black Rain, which is kind of what people saw, white light, and then they got black rain, and that was what they experienced. And I thought of that when our main character is like in the ashes of the city, and he starts like screaming like out of grief, and then there's just black rain is falling on his face, and it's like such a chilling image, you know, of like, obviously Godzilla is a, you know, nuclear weapon proxy. He's like a fictionalized version of a nuclear.
Yeah, those are nuclear blasts weapon, he's making. Right? They're looking for nuclear stuff. Yeah,
exactly. And so just like the image of him, like sitting in the ashes where his ostensible wife has potentially just died. And then he's like screaming as black rain falls on his face. Like, I'm going to remember that for a really long time.
It's pretty good. Yeah. My one question though is, am I even going to try to look for her? Am I going to try to?
Yeah. Well,
maybe find all, the body?
That's all I need to know.
She's gone.
She swept away.
Godzilla swept her away.
How did you guys feel about her not being actually?
I did not like that.
That's fine. Like that. Whatever. Let him be happy. Let this poor guy be happy. He's been through too much.
It's just, if you pin... First of all, I don't like when a female character is fringed in a movie. So it's like, that's not cool that you killed her. But if you're going to do it, have the courage of your convictions, please. You know? What did you think, Jeff?
I'm conflicted because I definitely usually think along those lines.
Yeah.
In this case, I kind of was like, I felt good. It felt
good. Poor
guy's
been he's been through too much. Okay. Like, he deserves it. My only thing is, like, I like the Noriko character, but when we're introduced to her, she is sort of like a really whip smart, charismatic character who's like talking back to him and like, it's like, I got this kid and I'm doing it because it's just what we do. And pretty much once they're like hanging out together, she immediately like reverts to nourishing wife who's taking care of it and motherly role. And that feels, there was just a jump there that feels like, oh, maybe she's wrestling with this. Maybe she's getting used to it too. It just seems like she immediately like went to that. And that it felt like we were skipping a lot of her character development too. I would have cared more about her, especially like potentially dying and stuff. Like, I would have cared more about her if the movie had built her up better.
She's kind of like plucky person on the streets in the opening scene, and then cut to 1 year later, she's a completely different person.
Yeah.
And
she's a mom. That's all she's
it's a plausible trajectory, but you're right. It's like missing from the movie, completely what happens to that character. So, let's see what else.
Yeah, we get two. Oh, are they dead? No, they're not dead moments. Cause the parishute moment also,
which
felt cool. We get that little flashback to him, like, and I built an ejector seat into this one.
Well, I loved that the message of the movie is like, hey, in short, kamikaze pilots were a bad idea. We shouldn't have done it. Okay.
Terrible.
It was a bad idea. We should have valued life more. And then that mechanic guy is the embodiment of that message. Of how they've changed, of like, hey, I thought you should have sacrificed yourself for Godzilla before, but now I'm putting in the ejector seat so you don't need to die. You know, like, I found that to be very moving. Like,
I love that they brought that character back, because normally they would disappear, right? Or have another function, but he basically ends up becoming an ally at the end. And this is a movie about understanding, like, we all went through this war. It kind of messed us all up. You know, we're just trying to get through this together. That's the only way we can survive. And it's all very moving.
It was very powerful when he like finds him. He's like tries so hard to find him. And then of course the guy is like resistant to.
Well, the only way that he can find him is by pissing him off, which is pretty great too. It's funny.
I like that. Yeah.
But also the blowing of the top of Godzilla's head off was pretty rad. I was a little bummed that at the end it's like Godzilla's back. Cause I was like, how great is it? They have the balls to just make a one-off Godzilla movie. Godzilla is introduced at the beginning as a threat. He's eliminated as a threat. We don't need to worry about sequels. We just like make this one self-contained movie. And then at the end, it's like, nah, he's all right.
What was even the last shot? I couldn't even figure out what was going on.
Do you remember the moment where his skin grew back earlier in the movie?
Yeah.
It was just that underwater. Yeah. He's growing back.
It's for his back. Skull. Yeah.
Yeah. Which I felt like, you didn't have to do that movie. I mean,
the third time you think someone's dead in the movie and they come back.
That's true. It's I mean, that's the culture we're into, right? That's
what are Marvel we watching? Vacation. Rise of Skywalker? Okay, anyway. I know. It's
we could have lost that completely. It didn't really bother me. It's just I expect that in movies now too, right? Nothing is ever truly dead. And also this Godzilla regenerates. You know, it has to be harder is the thing.
It was frustrating because I felt like, he blew the top of its head off. Mm-hmm. No coming back from that.
Right. I mean, I think we have to acknowledge that this Godzilla was pretty OP, you know, like pretty overpowered.
I mean,
I guess that's true in general, but
that's the whole. I mean,
that's the whole. He's huge. Like this one is really big, but I do have to say my favorite modern reinterpretation is the Shin Godzilla one because it's just so. It's just like a nightmare. It's just like this thing that has been in the water for too long and it comes out and it's bigger than any Godzilla before. It has that horrible face too. Like that is a fun little creature.
There was one moment at the beginning that I thought was humorous if you think about it too long, which is, you know, you see that Jurassic Park style attack where Godzilla is just like chomping bodies and throwing bodies. And, you know, you have that whole, throwback to the porta potty thing from Jurassic Park. But and then later, like right after that scene, he comes upon all the bodies and they're all just regular old bodies. I was like, I think there'd be pieces of these people.
There'd be pieces. The other it's all under the blanket. The other guy, like, put them all back together. It's really kind. Yeah.
Very funny to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I hope there's another one of these, you know, in this kind of universe.
What are you gonna call it? Minus one, two?
Godzilla zero? That doesn't
Godzilla
make any
plus
sense.
Two. Yeah.
Godzilla,
We just go negative. Minus two. Godzilla minus two.
I hope they kind of like, they can hop into this universe. I hope like we have the American one going side by side, but we never got a full sequel to Shin Godzilla and that ended in a really cool way. So
wasn't there Shin something else?
There was Shin Kamen Rider, which Hideaki Anno was also, working on. Yeah. I need to see that.
But overall, I had a great time. Oh, by the way, I do just want to acknowledge, I think it was kind of interesting the way, like, it goes by so quickly in the movie. Like, it happens, like, in 10 seconds. But I think, basically, it's, like, United States weapons testing is what woke Godzilla up again, right? And I think it's funny, they just sped right through that. They're like, you already get that. We don't need to go into that again.
We know what's up. Yeah.
We know what's up. So
let's not talk about why they were testing weapons and stuff. You know, let's just,
Spider-Man got bit by a spider. You get it. You know, understand.
Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, that's Godzilla Minus One. And at the end of the day, it's really impressive that Takashi Yamazaki made a movie. You can find more episodes of this podcast at thefilmcast.com. Email us at /filmcast@gmail.com. Find us on Patreon at patreon.com/filmpodcast. This episode's theme song came from Tim McEwen from The Midnight. Our spoiler bumper and weekly plugs music comes from Noah Ross, who also edited this episode. Next week on the podcast, the current plan is to review Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom, the second Aquaman movie,
Which so is a curious. Movie that exists.
So yeah. curious how this movie's going to do. the first one made $1 billion. And I don't
Are
know
we
that
go
this
to the theater.
Gonna...
They're like, guys, it's we're still working on it. Just sit tight. Sit tight.
I don't know that this one's going to do quite as well. But anyway, Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom. And also our After Dark, our current plan is Maestro. So that is our plan for the film cast next week. Thanks so much for listening. Until then, we'll see you later. Goodbye.